Hello friends, I'm your host Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Terry, how are you?
Fine. How are you, Chris?
I'm honoured, my love, that after, you know, our paths have sort of crossed on the bookosphere, because we've both got books out there, and I know that we've chatted on and off for years. I don't know if that's through Instagram or what, and to finally meet you, and also to chat to someone who's got a sort of a, can I say, a banged up abroad type story. That's great. I mean, that's where I live my life, is to meet exciting, you know. Okay, I guess it wasn't exciting at the time, but it's not your run-of-the-mill story, is it?
No, it's it's been a quite an horrific journey from start to finish. Yeah. Obviously good reading. So yeah,
we should point out from the beginning that you were innocent, which makes it more of, a lot of the banged up abroads, they did it, didn't they? But in your case, you were not so much stitched up, but you were in bad, can we say, bad company?
Yeah. I think anything abroad is a different ball game altogether. I've heard so many stories. It's shocking. And I still to this day are getting stories coming out of people waiting 8 years for sentences to go through on silly little crimes that only carry a 2-year jail sentence, and they're literally waiting 8 years to be brought to sentence. And the fact is that you are guilt by association. So even if you're not committing the crime, just because you're with somebody who's committing a crime, you're gonna be judged, and you are going to be tried in a court with no innocent or guilty plea put in. Mm-hmm. No, it's a total different ball game over there. And to have quite large chunks of your life taken from you and stolen from you, it's quite nerve wracking, really. Even to this day, today I've had a message from somebody who's still awaiting a trial 8 years on of something that was very, very trivial. Yeah, even in this country, you probably wouldn't even get sentenced for it. So yes,
just going to say, Terry, in this country they've got this, what's the bloody PPR, the order where they can keep you in jail indefinitely. It coming under that, under Blair.
I can't think now.
The name slips my mind, but I know that Pepsi Watson was on it, and they've just recalled him for absolutely nothing. He didn't.
So when you come out here in Britain, because obviously I was released back in the UK, you come out on a prison license. So yeah, you can get recalled at any time on that license for any trivial thing that you're doing. Yeah. And then of course, there are like the first, second and third strike. So a third strike, you still get lifed off, and you'll get lifed at a 3-year sentence. And then, yeah, they won't let you out until they feel fit that you are allowed to come out. So, yeah, it's but the prison license is tough, like really tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. The one Pepsi's on is just evil. Sorry for friends watching. Someone put it below in the comments what we're talking about. So if anyone is annoyed or wants to know, you can just look in the comments. But it's God, the poor bloke was in tears, and they were tearing him from his, from his girlfriend's house. And if you know Pepsi, it's really hard to put the two together to justify what you're seeing. It's just horrible. Yeah. He's a really, really nice guy. He does so much for other people. And it's like he's harmless. But back to your story, Terry, sorry. So what was it like then, rocking up in Tenerife as a young woman? It sounds a bit idyllic.
I first went to Tenerife when I was 15 years old. And as soon as I stepped off that plane, I was like, oh, I want to live here. This is great. Because Veronica's was huge back then. It was like 100 bars and discos all topped on top of one another. It was jam-packed down there. And it was just, it was just the life, basically, on this lovely like island with sun 24/7 and then all these clubs. And yeah, and I remember walking down there the first night, obviously with my mum and dad then, because yeah, I was quite young. And I just thought, yeah, I want to be this. I want to live here. So yeah, and obviously it took me quite a while to move out there. And yeah, I think I was about 22 when I eventually went, but we'd gone on holiday every year running up to that, me moving there. And it's just a dream come true, really, to be working in sort of an idyllic situation. I think there can't be a lot of children that don't cross their minds that they want to travel at some point in their life and just go away and work in either sort of like Ibiza and all them sort of areas. It is beautiful.
It's the heat that hits you getting off the plane, isn't it?
And it's been freezing here again this year. Yeah, this time last year in lockdown, I was very brown. It was very warm, and this year has been miserable. Yeah, so we've been in this awful predicament again, but the weather's been bad. And of course, it's funny, you know, because 2 years ago today was the last time I was in Tenerife for my birthday. I called over there today to say to him, I haven't seen you for 2 years. I've not been back in this island for 2 years. I've had six holidays cancelled. Yeah. And I'm stuck in miserable Britain. And all I want to do is feel that heat when I walk off that aeroplane. Please. But yeah, even in the winter, sort of like for us, it got colder, but yeah, still warm. It's lovely. Yeah, it's one of them. If you like the sun,
that's the place. What's the first sort of job you did over there? Because I know you did some of this bar promotion work.
That's the work. Yeah. So when I first got there, it was all very much the hype and being in the thick of it. I was a PR down on Veronica's. Yeah. Yeah, that was my first sort of job before sort of like it all went wrong. And then after sort of that, sort of after the problem, that's when I got proper jobs. So, yeah, the first sort of year was all about the party scene, and that's where it was, thick in Veronica's, being a PR, earning absolutely nothing, but not giving a care in the world. We were having great fun. Yeah. So 1,000 potatoes a night, if that, but still we were loving life. Yeah, loving it.
What year was it, so we can all
dial it in? I moved there in 1996.
After the sort of dance era in the U, well, not after, but
yeah, it was just
no, done. Yeah, it was. It was still in full flow though, wasn't it? In 96, it wasn't.
My first sort of party, my first rave, I think I went to in 1991, because yeah. I started work at the Sanctuary in 1992. So I was thick in the rave scene, absolutely in it up to about here. So, I was an Exodus girl. So I was in the free party scene before I went into the sort of more clubbier scene of the Sanctuary. I was in the thick of it.
And these names that you're saying, are they in Tenerife or are they in...
No, they're back here in the UK. Okay. Exodus was the illegal party scene from Luton, which was the original free parties. They were the movement that put the people out in the party scene. And then after that was the big Sanctuary, which was in Milton Keynes, which was a purpose-built rave for it held over 3,000 people. And it was brilliant. And they ripped it down. Worst thing they ever did was took our Sanctuary away. But they literally purpose-built this warehouse for raves.
Yeah.
So I got a job behind the bar. So I got paid to rave, really. Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah, loved that job. And then sort of when I moved to Tenerife, it was still that, sort of, but not that rave scene. It was more of the sort of handbaggy garage sort of move. Yeah. The move
Was it like a lot of sort of Euro dance, like Corona, Rhythm of the Night and...
all them sort of, it was a 1996-97 sort of that sort of era of not sort of the bouncy rave, like happy hardcore. So you moved on and it was more the party sort of club scene, but more garagey sort of, it wasn't as hard. I don't think there was anywhere in Tenerife apart from a little club which is more Spanish orientated that had more of that sort of music, but not the heavy rave scene that was back in the UK.
So I was on Ibiza a few years ago, and my God, let's just say anything that you wanted to buy, was just
everywhere.
You just asked any taxi driver, right? And then not only did he, you know, did they buy it like that, but also it was top notch stuff, especially as everything in the UK had been pants for years by this stage, right? So was that the same in Tenerife? I'm guessing there was a lot of mules coming there from.
So when I was back in the UK in the rave scene, obviously, I was doing sort of more of the ecstasy and the amphetamine and a couple of the acid. So it was more of the sort of the rave scene as such. And it was only when the pills got really bad when Leah Betts died that I decided, I'm not doing this anymore. So they were very clean. And then all of a sudden, it all become very scary for me because somebody died. It was like, no, I'm not doing them anymore. So, I can't remember the last time I did work. I think it must have been, 1991, 92. And I never touched one since. She died, basically. But when sort of like in Tenerife, I can't remember ever being a lot of pills being about. I can't, but there was a hell of a lot of cocaine. It was more your party scene for cocaine than what it was. I can't remember there being any amphetamine over there or acid, but there probably was, and there probably was ecstasy. But it was more about the cocaine. Yeah.
And how was all this coming to the island? I mean, I'm looking at the geography now. It is kind of a direct hop from South America, isn't it?
Well, when obviously me and Antonio went to Brazil on this holiday, where he came back with the cocaine, you cannot fly direct from Tenerife to Brazil. So we had to go into the Canary Islands. We had to hop over into the Canary to go on the holiday. So, but then usually what happens is, because when I found out in the prisons in mainland Spain, is when they're coming from South America to it's Amsterdam, the run, they drop into Madrid to refuel. And that's where most of the drugs get caught, is in Madrid. So that's where it's coming into from South America, and then obviously goes out into the islands. But that's the main sort of drop off. Is into the mainland, not the Canary Islands as such. I'm not sure the ins and outs of it all onto the island of what and how it all gets in there, but obviously it does. But I'm not sure. I suppose they have all their little mules that bring it in and out, like Antonio. But then it was always bigger than him. He's not the big boy, so no. Mm.
Did I gather a hint from your book? Had you got into, can we just say, into trouble with coke, or was it just?
Oh God, I got quite a bit of a habit by then. It's quite an easy one to get into a habit with, to be honest with you. Like with ecstasy and amphetamine, it was always about the party. It was always touch and go, so it was always a weekend thing. Whereas in Tenerife, it's 24/7. You literally, because you're in the thick of it and in a party, and it's there all the time. And because you have to, it's like the Dutch courage, as we used to call it. And the fact is that, long working nights, and it's just part and parcel of the job out there. Well, obviously not all of them, but a lot of them.
I get it. When I lived in Hong Kong, when I was addicted to crystal meth, you could go. I mean, I wouldn't go out of the house till sometimes 4 a.m.
Yeah.
Go downtown, meet all my mates, they'd all be in the club, and it's like, all right, and we'd just start dancing and
Within Tenerife, it's most of the nightlife doesn't start till 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night. And you can still go literally all the way through. Yeah, it's a bit like Ibiza really in the height of the summer. That's just literally party. I think this is why I was under the assumption that you were somewhere from like America zone, because obviously we don't have crystal meth here, thank God. It's not really our shores. It's quite thank God it hasn't really hit Britain. It's another ball game altogether. There's sort of addictions, and then there's that one. And it wears me out thinking about it, to be honest with you. I'm just glad it's never got here as much, really. I honour you for what you've come through, because that's hard work, very hard.
It's really kind you say. I just should point out for people listening, so we don't all get confused, is like my battle was with addiction. It was a mental health condition.
Yeah.
The party lives, that was the good, well, wasn't always good, and people died, but that wasn't the issue. I for the most part, had a great time, or at least thought I was having a great time, met amazing people and learned massive amounts about myself that I was basically told I was a failure at in school. So my challenge, Terry, I don't know how well you relate to this, it was like, coming from a traumatized childhood, I was naturally predisposed to want to bury this trauma. And of course, if you give me a substance, whether it's chocolate, coffee was my first addiction. It was coffee. At 10 years old, I used to run home from school to put the kettle on for a coffee. I didn't know why I did that. Obviously, looking back, it was my first, me trying to bury this.
I'm not quite sure why I was trying to bury, nothing really. Well, I was later on, but I think the initial, but I think with the party drugs, it wasn't about getting addicted to it. It wasn't about taking thousands of pills every day, because that wasn't how it was, and you couldn't have done that back then anyway. Mm. It was all about the party at the weekend, and it was all about just going out and having fun, and the music, and just feeling the love, because it was the, oh my God, the raves. I won't take that back for only. I still like to go out to raves, just not, they're not as sort of like what they were back then, but I still love the music. It's all about the music. It was never about the drugs, and it was more about the people in the park, because you will never take them memories away from the park, never. I've got some wonderful memories of my raving days, but that wasn't an issue then, and I never took drugs then to escape. I think I took drugs then because it was more of a curiosity thing, and the fact is that I had to stay awake all night, and part and parcel with it went with that. It was later on that I used substances to numb the pain, basically, of what I was going through with the trials and my dad's death, and it was all different things like that. So that was when the darker days come in. But the original, even in Tenerife, the first sort of time that I was with it there and doing little bits and bobs, it was quite fun. It was only till later that I realised, oh dear, I might have a little bit of a problem here. But then with that addiction with crystal meth. Because I will say, I remember being at a drug meeting when we first came out of prison, And there was a little lad there, and he tried it. And his words were, I had to go back on the crack because I felt like I'd been raped. And that was that, really. And I was like, oh, okay, right, we'll move along the bus then. So, yeah, I think it's a totally different ballgame. So, but then all addictions are addictions. But this one, I get worn out thinking about how I cope with it. So, yeah, I hold my hands up to you every day. Because I don't think I'd probably have got through that one. No.
I should point out as well, just to keep us all grounded, it was the alcohol was the... Alcohol was the way worse. I should be honest about the meth. I completely lost my mental. You know, I literally went... I was phasing in and out of psychosis. And the bad periods of psychosis were really bad. I mean, I was walking down the street talking to myself and, you know, imagining that guy was talking to me. So I'd go and talk to him. And, of course, he'd looking at me going, who the frick are you?
I've seen videos of people on it, obviously, because I've seen documentaries, but I've never personally ever come into contact because, as I said, it's not here. But alcohol, yes, I'm glad you brought, because obviously alcohol is my biggest issue. Alcohol for me, oh my goodness, and I can just go out my house and get it. So, that for me has been my biggest problem because it's everywhere. And God's sake, I do dread to think how much I drank in Tenerife. I to this day, I'm surprised I come home or my liver came home with me, to be honest with you. But alcohol is, it's hard work. Very hard.
You know, we're in a mental health, let's call it what it is. It's an epidemic in this country. There's so many unhappy people. Everything that's just gone on is going to make it so much worse. I mean, people have just been drinking all day long in their houses. And it's, I'm not pointing this out to upset anyone. I'm pointing out to tell you the truth. As a substance misuse specialist, the worst thing we worked with was the alcohol. Everything else causes so much chaos that you have to give it up, you know? You can only be clinically insane for so long before you have to have a word with yourself, right? But the alcohol is it's legal. Everybody pushes it on you. No one very few people recognize the danger. So it's like, go and have another one when it's destroying you, your family, and your children are being neglected, or physically or mentally abused, and your mates are still going, go and have another one.
Yeah.
And in the end, I used to say, I'll have another. Just could you phone my missus and just check that's all right? And then they'd go, oh, all right, yeah, I get it. Sorry. And it's like, yeah, it's fucking, you're thinking about you.
Yeah. Not me. Well, to be fair, I should have realised that, I would have had issues with alcohol. Well, not that, see, my mum and dad were very, very good with it, that they let me drink in front of them. It was never hiding away. But I remember getting drunk for the very first time, and I was on a twinning in Ladbrokes, and I was only 14. And I'd snuck two bottles of wine off and drunk the whole lot, and I nearly died. My mum found me up in a forest being sick. And that was my first alcohol experience. Now, really, I should have realised then, but possibly not for me. Maybe I should knock it on the head. And that was as young as that age. But then back then we were huge binge drinkers. Oh my goodness, it was massive binge drinking at the weekends. But I can't ever say that my mum and dad didn't teach me about alcohol. Because they did actually let me drink with them and in front of them. So it wasn't a fact that, I was hiding in a corner, in a hedge. But obviously back then, I still didn't have very, very strict ways with alcohol at all. No. And I've seen more damage done through my life with families through alcohol. Totally. Yeah. But this pandemic has sent everybody. See, the thing is, Chris, when I went through all my trouble in the 14 years that I had my issues with everything, I was all by myself on the prison bus. Nobody else was going through what I was going through. Nobody knew what I felt. But this time, everybody's on the bus with me and everybody knows how we're all feeling. And now they're all turning into alcoholics because they couldn't cope. So maybe they'll realise why I went round the wrong way, because this is how, yeah, it's quite frightening. Life's all about the journey, and life was all about what happened to me. Just as I thought I got it right, yeah, something else has come and, yeah, dropped it all out. So, yeah. Yeah, it had to be brought up as much as anything, because yeah, this has been another lockdown or anything really. Yeah,
of course, it's got deeper implications for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And everybody said to me, "Oh God, you'll know this. You've been in prison for 3.5 years." No, let's not think about that. Let's think about the fact that this has brought back terrible memories of me being stuck back in a cell. I think that people don't realise this. 3.5 years, long time to be in a prison. And then for me to be enforced into a situation again here, of which, yeah, it's been very similar to being back in prison.
Back to your story. Yeah. So you've met this guy.
Yeah.
And you've gone to Brazil. You thought you were going on a trip and his wife couldn't make it. Was it in Madrid that they pulled you?
No, it was in Gran Canaria, because, as I said, we were living in Tenerife at the time. And so to get to Brazil, we had to fly via Gran Canaria. So it's only a short flight from Tenerife. It was only about a 20-minute flight. So from Gran Canaria to Brazil. So it's dropping into Gran Canaria Airport that his bags got stopped. Yeah.
Wow. And that moment, again, from reading your book and the magazine articles, it sounds like an episode of Banged Up Abroad, when the coke goes everywhere.
It was in my life. Yeah, it was. Well, everything was perfect, and within seconds, my life just went upside down. Within seconds, I went from being this carefree young girl living in Tenerife, having the time of my life, to being a frightened fugitive, basically. Yeah, and I'd never been arrested before. And to be arrested in an airport with a lot of drugs, with guns to heads, and people shouting at me in Spanish, it was like a movie, like a surreal. It's like I'd stepped into an episode or a film, but I was in it. And, I didn't want to be in it. Yeah, it was horrible. It was surreal. Very surreal that, one given time, your life can change in seconds.
So in that moment, did it become blindingly obvious what had happened, or were you sort of in shock or in denial, or did you realise this guy was trying to import gear and now he'd been caught and you were tied into it with him?
Yeah, so what happened was our bags were both checked. Obviously, they checked mine, nothing in it, and then they checked his. And the first one, they were fine. The second one, obviously, they got a bit suspicious of him. They were doing this. And then they took him into the back room and left me outside with my trolley, with the trolley. And the next thing I know, that's when, obviously, they discovered the false bottom in it. And that's when they pulled me into the room. And that's when, and I walked in and I was thinking, what the hell's going on in here? And that, then I knew something, obviously, wasn't right, and that's when they'd obviously discovered the 4 kilo of coke was in the bottom, and it was flying everywhere, absolutely, because they were trying to shovel it into bin bags. And that's when I realised. But then, because I was so young and so very silly and naive, and then Antonio was shouting at him and then shouting at me, saying, no, it's fine, she, nothing to do with it, no, me, I'm it, it was all about it. And so he was trying to tell me, don't worry, I'm going to tell them you're not involved. I'm going to tell them to let you go and it'll be all over. So then I was sat there thinking, well, yeah, I haven't got nothing to do with it. So it's all his. So I won't get arrested. I'll be fine. I'm just going to walk out and go home and everything's going to be all right. And then as it slowly, they locked me in a cupboard for hours, of which I was jet lagged. So I must have fallen asleep in there. Then they pulled me out and questioned me like 3 or 4 questions, which weren't very well translated at all. Then they put me back in the cupboard, and then they brought me back out of the cupboard, and that's when they put the handcuff Oh, sorry.
That's all right. There we go.
Yeah. Then they put the handcuffs on me, and that's when I sort of knew, oh, something wrong here. And they put my coat over the top of it to make it so that I didn't look like I'd been arrested. But then I was surrounded by quite civil officers, and yeah, it didn't look quite sort of the part. So then they took me up to the local police station in Gran Canaria, and then it hit me in there. And then I knew I was in a lot of trouble, and I could not stop crying. And it wasn't until that moment that I knew something wasn't right. And then when we got took down the following morning, because we were took to court, me and Antonio, they put us in a cell together. And that's when I said to him, "What the hell's going on?" And he said, no, it's fine. I'm going to make sure you don't ever go to prison, and that I'm going to tell him who I work for. It's fine. I will always look after you. But this is Spain. Antonio, this is Spain. You're not going to protect me because they don't care. I'm with you, and that's all that matters. And that was it, really. And that's the last time I really saw him. I saw him at court the following year. Because none of it was translated to me. I was only in there for an hour with him.
Terry, were you having a sort of affair with him?
No. Okay. He was, Antonio for me was more like a father figure. I'd known Antonio for years before moving out there, because obviously I'd been out there lots of summers before, and I worked for a month, a couple of years running up to moving out there just to get a feel for it. So I knew him quite well. And at that time I was missing the family a little bit, and my dad, and he was a lot older than me. And yeah, I used to go up there and talk to him quite a lot, but then he always had the drugs. So yeah, it was more of a...
He's... Can we say he's used you, isn't he? Because he didn't want to be going for an airport on his own. No, it would have looked obvious.
No, that's what he said to me. But then again, we didn't look quite the part, really, because, I was quite young and he was quite older. So really, yeah, we didn't quite fit the bill. So, I think, obviously they have their own mindset of thinking about how they traffic drugs. And obviously when you swallow, it's a different ball game, but when you're carrying in bags, yeah, they try and take a mule, or not a mule with them, but an accomplice with them, so that it looks a little bit easier going through. But then I don't know if it was all explained to him, because every bag from South America gets checked. So I don't know whether he thought, like in Heathrow, we were going through nothing to declare or declare. Whereas no, when you're coming back from South America, every bag gets checked. But I don't know in this country, because I've never flown to South America from Britain, so I don't know what the procedure is here. I don't know, because I've never come for an airport here from that far.
Yeah.
But I know...
A lot of it's done on intelligence, though, isn't it? They know already who they're going to search, because they're... And in some countries, it's all corrupt. They'll take 10 drug mules, knowing 9 of them they're going to let through because they're getting a backhander. And the one that they're like a sacrificial lamb, because if they grab the one, it looks like they're doing their job.
Yeah, well,
they know who it's going to be. So when you get sent on this job, the people in the airport already know before you've even got on the plane that when you come back, it's going to be that person. This is what I gather from the Banged Up Abroad programs, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I think with Antonio, because obviously he worked for 2 police officers and a judge, right? So he was under the assumption that he was just one, he was going straight through, and nobody was going to blink an eyelid at him. But the cocaine that he was carrying was 50% base. It was absolute pure crap, basically. In this country, the judge would have probably said to him, "Where'd you get that from?" And then I always knew, well, looking back on it now, I think I know who's taking the big lot through. And because they were busy, yeah. So later on, all things fit into place and you think, oh, yeah, I think I know what was going on there. So it is. I think it's all corruption. But yeah, then,
while they bust the guy who's got the rubbish stuff, the person behind them with the good stuff walks through.
But then again, what was Antonio's rubbish, or was it quite pure? They bashed it, took what they wanted to take out of it, and then put what they wanted to put forward.
This is Spain, so I'm going to say most likely. I mean,
yeah, most likely.
They love that stuff over there. not all of them, but.
And the fact is that the people that he were working for were very, very high up. And you do wonder that, yeah, they took theirs, put something else in. Because 50% base cocaine from Colombia, I'm sorry. Obviously, no, it's not washing with me now. Yeah. Most of the banged up abroads I have watched on there, that most of the stuff that they bought for you is near on pure coming back from Colombia.
There's that thing, isn't there, that Latino men, so I'm talking, well, Euro Latino, so Portugal, Spain, they can be really freaking violent, can't they?
Oh God, yeah. I've always said to this day that thank God we didn't get stopped going out of the airport in Brazil, because I wouldn't be. No, neither of us would be here. For one, I don't think we'd have got out of the airport, and for two, I wouldn't have survived their prisons.
Yeah. No, I meant the Latinos, as in the Spanish. What I mean is, I was on ship for a year, and we pulled into Portugal.
All right. Yeah, I know what you're on about.
We're all getting rowdy in one of their bars. It was actually a square in Lisbon in Portugal, and the whole ship's company was starting to misbehave. And then on a queue, when someone actually started to get like fisticuffy, all the barmen jumped over the bar. They grabbed chains, not axes. I mean, it wasn't that bad, but they were grabbing chains, baseball bats, and they weren't afraid to just plow in and use them. When the police turned up, it wasn't like an English copper. So tell me what's happened here. Right. What's your story? None of that. It grab you, throw you in a wagon.
Yeah.
Cart you off. And and it's even a bit like that in even in Scandinavia. I mean, I've been stopped by Swedish police, and they're just fucking horrible, you know.
Well, I think my first, I knew about the Tenerife police, the Guardia Civil, and the local police here. I'd heard rumours about the corruption even when I was a holidaymaker over there. But I think my first worst sort of scenario was I was in one of the nightclubs, and it was quite early hours of the morning, and two officers walked in with guns on, two lines up their nose, took a wad of cash and walked out. And I looked at them and thought, oh, and this is what we're up against. Okie dokie, got ya. Mm-hmm. So and them two went out, fizzled on the red on cocaine with two guns strapped to them. So it was that was my first sort of
So
life is going to be quite tough over there. I think that's the only thing that mars the islands, all of them, is the police and the Guardia Civil. It's just the pure corruption that goes on within the walls of the islands that will always ruin the life over there. So, because I've always thought, I'd love to go back. I'd love to go back in there and live, because the island for me was never the issue. It was my lifestyle that was quite a chaotic problem. And then I sit back and think, oh my God, could I cope with all that corruption again? And could I cope with all these problems? And I know the police here aren't exceptionally great sometimes, but at least in our court system, you've got sort of like a legal leg to stand on, and you've got a hope in hell a chance of getting somewhere. But yeah, that frightens me over there still to this day. But to be fair, the amount of people I've met over the years and the horror stories that I've heard from different countries, I possibly wouldn't travel again if I listened to and took all of them into. So yeah, I think sometimes you have to realise that wrong time, wrong place, really. But the corruption is rife in most foreign countries. Yeah, you especially being an English person. Yeah, it's vile. Yeah, but I've heard some of the horror stories that I've heard over the years from people I've met. Yeah, I do wonder if I would ever travel again. So yeah, it's a shame. It's a big shame, huge shame.
Yeah, Well, Billy's story, isn't it? Billy Moore, bloody God, that the beginning of his film, or the film that was made about his book. So what was it? A Prayer Before Dawn. Before Dawn. Friends, if you get a chance to watch Billy's, read Billy's book or watch the film, oh my God, in the first 10 minutes, it'll make you sick.
Made
me feel really, really,
because I think in the justice system throughout the world is quite corrupt, but I think the prison systems are, prison's prison wherever you are, but Thailand is, it's totally different ball. Because I even said to Billy, I don't know how you are. I seriously don't. I know that my prison sentence and everybody's prison sentence is different wherever you are in the world, but I just, Thailand's just totally off the Richter scale. It's another prison sentence within it. So it's like South America as well. You may as well not, because them lot run the inside of the prison, don't they? It's not actually the guards that look after it, it's the inmates. So it's literally a prison within the prison walls, and then it's run by the prisoners. So I'm not sure even if I would have got out of a South American prison, to be honest with you. No, but Billy's stories, it's heart-wrenching. Some of the things that he had to go through.
I went to visit a girl in prison. I think I was in Ecuador. What you can do, so friends at home, when you're backpacking around the world, you can go into the, I won't even pretend I remember, but there's various services that you can contact them and say, look, I'm in so-and-so. Are there any British prisoners in the local nick? And they'll give you the names of the people that put their name down to be visited, because obviously their family's a long way away. There I was, I think it was Ecuador, and very violent place. Again, lots of people arrested for drugs, drug currying. And I rocked up there, and you do all the get searched and everything, don't you? You go in, and then I'm sat in this waiting room, and this girl came and she went, "Hurry, I was asleep. What, who are you?" And I said, "I'll come to visit." And she's like, "Really? Oh, thank you." And I bought her a big pack of toilet rolls, because apparently that's one of the things that they really had hard to get. And she was saying that everything she had to hustle for. So you got to start a little business. So hers was, she got a coffee maker from the consulate, bought her a coffee maker. Then she could make little coffees for people. Then she bought a mattress with a floor, and then she bought a bed. And it was like...
I think the prison set, it's like in Spain. Yeah, the conditions weren't great at all. But they weren't on the level of some of the prisons that people have been in. I think more to the fact that the Spanish, it's the corruption that goes on. Although in the Spanish prison, I think it's because of the fact that you're in mixed prisons, and it's all just a different world out there. But that we had very few and far privileges as such, and most of it, if Mum hadn't have had the money to support me, I think life would have been totally different in the Spanish prison for me. And I couldn't work because I was an English girl, so they wouldn't let me work for my money. And of course, visits are very few and far between. And then phone calls and letters and did it. So, I couldn't even imagine. And I have seen footage of obviously the South American conditions and Thailand. But I couldn't even imagine being in prison there, to be honest with you. It was bad enough where I was. I don't know how anybody gets through them sentences at all, to be honest with you, because it was a struggle to get through mine in the conditions that I was in, let alone what they've been through. It's tough. It's tough thinking about it, but I don't try to dwell on that bit of it. At the end of the day, I got through it, and I'm here to talk to people like you.
You don't have to say anything that it's going to upset you or anything, Terry, but what was it like when you first had to call your parents then and say, I'm in a bit of bother?
The first phone, I was arrested on Thursday morning, and then I was took up to the local police and I wouldn't let the consulate phone my mum, you see, because I was of age. I said, no, you're not calling her. Because obviously I was under the assumption I was going to walk out of there and I wasn't going to have to call them. It wasn't until I got to the prison on the, so when was it, Friday night time it was. And I remember walking in there and one of the girls in there was from, was it Norway? One of them. And she was the only one in the prison that spoke English anyway. And she lent me her phone card quickly. And I literally phoned my mum. And this was 6 o'clock on a Friday night. Mum, I've been arrested. I'm in Gran Canaria Airport. I need bail money. And I had to put the phone down. And that was it. That's all I had. Oh, my God. And I tried to think what was at the other end here, because that was 6 o'clock, Friday night. Everything was shut. No phone calls to be made. And I've just dropped the biggest clanger that they've ever had in their lifetime in 3 words. And then put the phone down. Can you imagine? I can't even imagine what they went through at that time. I was bad enough. The fact is that I had to make that little phone call. But you imagine what was happening here. And they couldn't do anything. They couldn't make any fun. They didn't even know hardly where I really was, because I just sort of said, and they didn't even have been on holiday to South America. This was, oh my God, it was, yeah, I do actually think about, Jesus Christ, because Western Union wasn't that easy back then. Transferring money was quite hard experience. So yeah, and of course, no consulates was open, no this, no that. I can't even, I think Mum called John Burko. I can't remember. I think it was, she called the MP and then he made direct and found out where I was. I think this is how it all ricocheted through the weekend. And then I think they got the money wired over on the Tuesday morning, because obviously, yeah, nothing was open till, yeah, so I had to stay in there till then.
You got bail then?
Yeah, I got bail originally. Yeah, this is where all the problems came in, because they actually bailed me out of the prison back to Tenerife without a passport. And that's where the justice system all goes a little bit wrong after that, because it's all about this money and it's all about corrupt solicitors. It's all about more money. And yeah, and you just don't know whether you're coming or going, really. So
was jumping bail an option?
Well, see, when I came out, I'd been out, a week, and Mum flew over and we talked and we said, right, we're going to fight this. So we went to see a solicitor. And then that's when I had the aneurysm. I had the fatal brain hemorrhage on the Friday. So she flew out, I think it was a Sunday, and then on the Friday I got really ill. And then I was in hospital for 6 weeks, you see. And by that time, I'd missed all my deportation orders. I'd missed everything. So, and then I was so ill that wasn't an option then. It was, I had to stay and I had to fight it. So, no, doing a runner at that point was not even on the card. And Mum sort of said, because Mum's a very honest and very woman, that she said, look, right, if you've done nothing wrong, we're going to fight it. And we're going to fight, because obviously we didn't know about the corruption over there. We didn't know about the legal system being so bad. So she said, we're going to fight this. We're going to get a good solicitor and we're going to fight it. Yeah. But then I was so ill anyway, everything was took out of my hands at that point. So, yeah.
And what was it like then, Terry, when the judge said 10 years?
Oh, well, he didn't, right? So this is another thing. So in England, me and you, we go through the airport together. You've got drugs in your suitcase. I've got no drugs in my suitcase, but I'm with you. So we'd be arrested. And then I don't even know half the time whether through paperwork that I'd be taken to the police cells, or I would just be cautioned, or maybe, yeah, or given a court date. But you obviously plead guilty and then I plead not guilty. So then you probably stay on remand, but we'd be separated, totally separated. But at this point, I would never see you again and you wouldn't see me, especially at trial, because then you go for sentencing and then I'd have to go to trial and they'd have to prove that I was involved. And to prove that sort of, it's very difficult in the UK to prove a conspiracy case that you were actually knowingly with, especially if you come up and said, yeah, no, I work for XYZ. These aren't my drugs, but I'm the one carrying them. And she had nothing to do with it. It would, boof, that'd be it. Separated, gone. In Tenerife, no, we both go to the court, both sit there. There's no pleas put in. There's no guilty or not guilty. He stood up and talked for an hour, of which I still to this day have no idea what he said because none of it was translated to me. He just kept pointing at me. So hopefully he wasn't saying, yeah, it was all that. And then I think they asked me three or four questions, one of them being, which one's your suitcase, the green one? Oh, the one without the drugs in. Yeah, that's it. And that was it. We got up, we walked out. I went back to Tenerife on my aeroplane. He went back to the prison, got on the aeroplane. Lawyer's like, oh, yeah, fine. Finished, over with. You'll be fine. 2 days later, we get a phone call from the court. I've been sentenced to 10 years on a phone call with a 76 million peseta fine. And then, but you're not going to prison yet because you can appeal. And then there's the next one. And so it was just... It was the biggest circus of a court case you'll ever probably, yeah, but they probably, it's quite a few out there, but it is nothing compared to how you would be tried back in the UK. It is absolutely ridiculous.
At that point then, was it not just tempting to...
No, but by this time, I was into it. It was that thick of it that... And that much media was involved. It wasn't really an option at that time for me to get on a plane and run out. So we got more lawyers who were corrupt and wanted more money. So mum and dad were like nearly 60 grand deep in debt here. To be honest with you, I've actually got quite a good life over there now because I've got a proper job, I have a proper house. Everything was more normal. It was a normal life. It wasn't the chaotic Veronica's life. It was a nice life. And I liked my life in Tenerife. I'm a little cat. I'm a little house. I was, loving life again. And at that point, I didn't really want to come home. So it wasn't until the year 2000 that we were just getting quite sick of it all. And then John Burke, the MP, John Burko, got a letter from the one of the foreign officers, I think, which said in the translation, she was released in 97 on the date with no readmission. So then he said, well, is it not all over? And I said, well, I don't know, because we've heard nothing from the lawyers. I don't know where the appeal's gone. So mum and dad said to me at the Millennium, because they flew out to spend that big new year with me. And I said to them, shall I apply for a new passport? And they said, why not? So I filled all the forms out. They took it home. Week later, what arrives in my mum and dad's doorstep? New passport. Mum said, well, that's it. It must be over. So I said, well, I'll come home then. So then we planned to come home in the February. Now, I sort of knew we were doing something wrong, but we didn't know, basically. We did think it was all over, but half of me knew that it possibly wasn't. So what we did, because of the aneurysm, I didn't fly. So, I didn't want to fly all the way back to Britain, but then we didn't want to fly all the way back because we were going through passport control. So what we did was we went out of Tenerife to Madrid and then got the overnight plane from Madrid to Paris because there's no passport control. And then it was coming through... So we got Paris to Waterloo and it was coming back through Waterloo. So imagine we'd come all this way home, 2 days traveling, mid-month, loads of bags, and thinking, walk through Waterloo, little shit, come here, you two. Oh my God, really? They were adamant me and mum were carrying drugs, adamant, but little did they know it was me. I was the problem, but they took my passport off twice. Checked it, no problem. Because, of course, then there was no major Interpol, was there? There was no talking between countries and there was no European arrest warrant at that point. So I wasn't flagging up on their system that I was wanted. So, they let us through. But if they'd have checked the bags properly, in one of the bags was receipts from Tesco the day before when Mum had bought it off the daily counter. So, it was hindsight now because I spoke to quite a few people within the prison system about this, what we'd done coming home. And they said, your mum, you put her such a vulnerable situation, because if you'd have been nicked then, she would have been arrested as well. And that carries a huge sentence for carrying a fugitive back into the country. So looking back on it, yeah, it was very naughty what we did. I'm very, sort of bad of me for putting her into that bad situation, which I didn't think was a bad situation, but could have been really quite for mum to get me home. But then at that time, I just wanted to come home. And it was a good job that I did come home, because in the April, my father was diagnosed with cancer. And now looking back on it all, I really don't think I would have coped with that, with me being stuck out there. So sometimes things happen for a reason for you to come home. Yeah, and it wasn't until 2003 that they issued the European arrest warrant, and then they come and arrested me again at home. And this is 8 years on. No, 6 years on from the initial arrest. So, yeah, it's been... but I'll be honest with you, Chris. The only person I blame for all this fiasco within the legal system was the original judge that bailed me. Because if she had never bailed me, I would have run through the system and maybe have had a better chance of fighting the case within the prison. Because hopefully, well, you never know, Britain might have stepped in a bit more and helped me out, because then they could have followed the court cases. They could have helped me through the procedures. But because this initial judge gave me bail, it all went wrong from then on. But they always say that they think that they give you bail, so you'll do a run and go home. So yeah, then you're out of the system. But then why pick me up on a blooming European arrest warrant so many years on and cause all the flipping, rigmarole again? Because I had to fight a court case here for 2.5 years. To try and fight my extradition, because it was all because I got arrested on under the old warrant. So mine was the last case in Britain to be done on the old warrant. That's why it was thrown up in the court in the press, because the new warrant was literally they come to your house, pick you up, and throw you out at the airport, and you don't even have a chance to fight your case here anymore. So they wanted to know how I felt, and that's why the media took such a big interest in it. But then the government didn't help me either. So,
how long was it between what happened in the airport, you getting arrested, and you actually going and serving your time? That sounds like a load of years.
Yeah, 8 years. It was eight and a half years.
And how many did you have to serve over there?
I did. Well, I went back thinking that I'd have to do the full 10. That's when I initially got onto the air. Plane, that's exactly what I thought I was going to do, was a full 10 years. So when I stepped foot onto the island, Fair Trials International was still following my case. So they helped me to get a fresh lawyer to apply for the pardon, because the royal pardon, or the indulto as they call it, is the last procedure in there when you've rinsed all the court. That's the last thing you can apply for. It's a bit like in Thailand, I think, with the pardoning. So they found me a lawyer, which I was very dubious of getting because of the problems that we'd had previously. But she just won a massive court case through drugs, and she got her notch. So she was adamant, and she knew she'd win it. So I only saw her once in the prison, and she was very confident because she'd won this initial case. That she would win mine. So that was fine. It was a very small amount compared to all the rest of the money that poor mum had laid out. But I knew it would take a long time to get through. So at that point, I thought, right, I need to go back home again, because I need to go on a repat, because of the fact that it was too much for mum to visit me over there all the time. And I just wanted to come back to Britain because it was a lot easier. So I applied for the repatriation, and I served 19 months in Spain, and then 19 months back here in the UK. And then I was granted the royal pardon, or partial pardon, and they dropped my sentence from 10 to 6 years. So on time served, I got out on the prison licence. So, yeah, I did about 3.5 years in the end, and then three years on licence. So,
jeez, what a bloody rigmarole.
I know.
For something you didn't do in the first place. How have you come to terms with that injustice, Terry?
Well, I think over the years, I can't live with, it's like hatred. It's a lot of people say to me, do you hate Antonio? No, I don't hate him. because he did what he did. I don't like him a lot. I don't hate him because it's a bit of a strong emotion. With what went on with me, I don't know how to explain it to you. I try not to. I am very angry with the legal system, but I can't live with that anger because it will eat me up again. And I've got enough bits of issues to deal with to try and live my life as normal now as I can. But I meet so many people that have had an injustice against them. It's unreal. So I'm not the only one, and I won't be the only one ever again. Because once you think something's all right, it's not all right. And once you think you've got on top of something, I won't fight that on my own. I've done lots of talks for European lawyers and all different sort of with Fair Trials International and Prisoners Abroad. But I remember doing one talk with a lot of European lawyers, and I remember a little Spanish girl coming up to me at the end and saying that she tried to be legit, but she had Guardia Civil outside her house. She was threatened. She was this. And she said, how do I fight good with bad? Because I'm just fighting every day against a system that has got it up against you. So how do they do it? How in a system that is so bad do you fight it, really? It's quite frustrating, really. But at the end of the day, I've been through what I've been through. And it's made me who I am today. It's been tough. I won't deny it. It's been really tough. But then I'm not the only one. There's a lot of people out there with stories a lot worse than mine.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. But it's like possibly with you, I only wrote the book is to give people knowledge of what they are letting themselves in for. Sometimes knowledge is a better foresee, but then there's always people out there that will be making mistakes, and there's always a need for drugs, and there's always a need for this, and there'll always be a need for somebody to be bringing them drugs into the country, or somebody to be doing this, or somebody to be the XYZ. And we all know that this is how the world goes. But yeah, prison's tough. If you're a boy, girl, or whatever, it's tough, basically. Because I know most grown men, if you don't want to be in prison, it's not a good place.
Can we finish then, Terry? Sorry if this is a bit cliche, but what was it like then when you finally walked out those gates?
Well, I didn't look back. They told me never look back, and I didn't. I never looked back, and I've never looked back. That was their one advice to me. When I walked out of that prison, don't look back, Terry, and we won't be seeing you again. And I said, no, you won't. But it wasn't, it was a bit odd how I was released, because they got word in the afternoon that my pardon papers are coming. I had a funny feeling that it wouldn't be long. It was the last thing that NOMS, the offender management unit, opened up the email in the afternoon. She was going home, and then they had to sort all the dates out. And I remember my name being called over the tannoy. I'd just been on the phone to my mum moaning about the fact that nothing had been happening, and I thought, oh my god. And I walked in, and the governor was in there, and I thought, oh my god, I'll get shit out, what have I done wrong? And she said, better go and pack your bags, you're going home. I was like, you're kidding me. I literally run out of there, phone my mum, and screamed at her, mum, I've been released, come and get me. Put the phone down again. And that was it. So from start to finish, she had one phone call in Gran Canaria telling her that I'd been arrested, and then one phone call screaming at her to come and get me because I've been let out. So these two phone calls are very prominent in my sentence. But it didn't sink in because I was released at 7 o'clock that night. And I remember coming home here because I was under prison license. So I couldn't get involved with the media. Nobody could be told that I'd been released until later on. So I come home very quietly, and I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I was walking about the house thinking, Jesus, is this real? And then Mum got up as well, and it was like we dreamt it. It was possibly the most surreal moment of my life. But then two phone calls are prominent in my life. The one to tell her I've been arrested and the one to tell her I've been released. And they were literally three or four words screaming out, put the phone down. So, yeah, it was surreal. But I won't deny, Chris, life's not been easy since I've been out, not at all. And, I don't suppose it will get much easier for a while, but it might calm down one day. One day,
I'd recommend to anyone, if you're struggling, what on my YouTube channel, I've got a playlist. One of my playlists called The Commando Coach. And it's just, I'd recommend anyone struggling, just go and watch it, binge watch it over a weekend. They're all short videos. We also have a life coaching group on Facebook called, if you just go facebook.com/groups/Chris Thrall. And we just have a very positive, happy group on Facebook. We don't let any mainstream nonsense into it. No, so you're not going to see anything about, what's been on the news or anything like that, because we don't believe in watching it. And people are positive. We get up in the morning, we smile at the sun to say thank you for our lives. We jog around the block or walk around the block or cycle or whatever. We have a green smoothie at lunchtime because it makes us feel mental in a good way.
Good way.
and we always take action every day towards our perfect future. And when we're not feeling it, that's fine. We sit on the couch and we have a chill day, 2 days, week, month, whatever it takes to get us back. And these simple philosophies, Terry, have really helped a lot of people. We've got people recovering from some very nasty illnesses and stuff, and a lot of them had never heard of things like alkaline diet showing gratitude for life, which you've done. When you say there's always people that got it worse, that's being grateful, isn't it, for what we've got. So anyway, you're more than welcome to join us there. What does the future hold? And your book is Passport to Hell. I'm looking at it now. I'll put a link below, folks. Very well written. So there we go.
So at the moment, obviously, I want to get through this little blip in our lives again. And then hopefully life might come back to some sort of normality, whatever normal is. And we are in talks at the moment, have been for quite a few years, about putting this on the big screen. And that is something that I'd like to happen. I think that there's a lot of messages to come out in it, and it's got the rave scene, and it's got all the issues that I went through, I'm quite hopeful that it will happen. That's been my dream, that one day somebody would pick up on it. I've always been told that I'll write another book, but I'm not sure what the content will be. But they said I'm not to think too much about it because it will just happen. Possibly. But I think there's a book in everybody, to be honest with you. I think everybody could sit down and write a book. And to be as free as possible, really. So, and to be free of this again. So, I just want my freedom back. Because I fought so long to get it, and now it's been took away from me again. So, I just want us all to be free again.
Yeah.
So it would be nice to have our lives back, because, possibly if we took this interview, a couple of years back, we wouldn't be talking sort of on the line that we would have gone on to, because of the fact is that our lives wouldn't have happened, or this wouldn't have happened to us. But, it's... I'm hopeful that that will come off, and I like to not get too excited about it just in case it doesn't. But I'm quite secretly very excited about the prospect of this going on to different options and different avenues. So, life's just a little bit quieter for me. I just get up every day, go to work. I'm a little cleaner at the moment. I do what I love because I've got OCD, so love it. Best about the best cleaner in the whole world. And yeah, I just I'm thankful, like you, every day that I get up. The sun's, well, sort of out, and I wake up and I've still got my life intact. So yes, it's quite easy that yes.
And people can find you on Instagram. Is that the best way?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So yeah, I'm out and about on them, and yeah, and I'll answer any sort of questions that anybody has regarding all different issues that have been brought up on this and in the book. So, and sometimes with like my sort of mental health issues with the panic attacks and everything, and sometimes I just like to talk to people, and because it is good to talk. Yeah, I find that a lot of the time when I was suffering with the panic disorder when I come out of prison, I didn't talk to anybody, I didn't tell anybody about it, and that's when I suffered the most. But now when I feel quite sort of down, I'll go and talk to my mum, tell her what's going on, and then yeah, my mood sort of lifts a little bit. So yeah, it's always good to keep your friends around you and talk. Yes, so
definitely.
Yeah,
well, Terry, stay on the line because I'm going to hit the record button off. I just will thank you personally. So I will thank you now for the purpose of the camera. Terry, you're absolutely lovely. Please don't go changing. I'm so glad that you've come through what you have, and your head's in the right direction for a very bright future. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Oh no. Yeah. And anytime you want to come back, maybe our subscribers have got some questions they want to ask. We could do a live chat on YouTube, and they can put us questions in the chat. That would be
That's fine.
That
it's,
would be nice. So thank you again. Yeah. And to everybody at home, massive love to you all. Please look after each other, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah. Thank you. Hi everyone.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.